You're listening to the Writers Forum. I'm your host, Mike Tusa, and today I'll be speaking with poet Erin Hoover about her new poetry collection, No Spare People. Erin's poetry has won several awards, including the Florida Book Award and the Elixir Press Anti-Venom Poetry Award. Her poems have appeared in the Cincinnati Review, The Sun, and various other publications. She currently teaches creative writing at Tennessee Tech University. Welcome to the show, Erin.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Let me ask you at the outset to talk about the, I guess the right phrase is the poetic muse. You know, what is it? How is it that you know when you're going to write? I one time had a writer on who wrote fiction and poetry, a gentleman named Gary Goche, and he said, poetry is acute pain and fiction is dull pain. So talk to us a little bit about how you decide, okay, I'm going to write a poem. Is it just something you feel? Is it some thought that you have about a topic, or what is it?
Yeah, that's an interesting way that other writer put that. I think that I'm using poetry to address kind of existential concerns and choices about life and how to be an ethical person. So I tend to struggle through those things in my poetry, because, you know, during the day, of course, we're all making choices in how we're going to live and who we want to be. But we're not necessarily verbalizing those choices to everyone, or that thought process is not really externalized in any way. And for me, that's what poetry does for me. I also really like poets and poems who do that, who, you know, you sort of think things like, you know, the environment, kind of under threat right now with so much stuff with climate change, and you know, where do I think about that? I don't necessarily talk about that in the office or talk about it with my students, but I write about it. I write about, you know, how do I want to make a family, or, you know, what kind of family deserves to be called a family? I think every kind of family does, actually. Sure. but you know, I talk about that in poetry. So,
and yeah. We're going to talk a little, I see that you did that in this collection a lot, some of these different issues. But I guess I'm curious in part whether you just suddenly feel like you have to write, or whether you already know what your topic is going to be when you sit down to write.
Well, I can keep a topic cold for a while. So if I have something I want to write about, I'll just make a note in my phone about it. And then I try to block off like a good period of time, at least 2 hours, so that within that time frame, I can do more exploratory writing. You know, I'm not someone who has a specific time that I have to sit down every day or anything like that. But within the week where I can find these blocks of time, I try to keep the idea cold in my mind until I can heat it up in that writing session.
Okay. All right. Well, let's jump in and let's talk about the new collection. Where does the title come from? No Spare People.
Yeah. So that's actually a line in the last poem in the book, which I'll tell you that title, cause it's one of my favorite titles I've ever come up with. The poem is called What If Pain No Longer Ordered the Narrative? And that poem also touches on a major theme of the book, which is that I'm a single parent. I have one daughter who I conceived with a donor. So our family is very small. And you know, when you have a really small, I think anytime you have a family, you're sort of always going through life trying to ignore the potential loss of your family members. Or family member. And for us, since we're such a small family, I was thinking one day, I thought, well, you know, one of us will die first. Either I as a parent will pass away and she'll be alone. She won't have any family left, or even worse, if she passed away and I was alone. So we have no, quote, no spare people in that way. That's the personal reading of it. Mm-hmm. The other is that, I live in Tennessee, which has some really interesting laws about family and who has the right to have a partnership, what bodily autonomy looks like. And so some people are, I think of them almost like, you know, it's excluding some people, or it's saying you're extra or you don't count. And so the book's title is also an imperative that there are no spare people. Right. So it's a double edge, right? Because it's first using the idea of extraness or spareness, and then it's rejecting it.
Well, you know, it's fascinating. I the title drew me in, but I didn't really understand what it was until I read the poems, and then I saw it connected. And you may have just answered this question in part, but if my count is right, there's 29 poems in the collection. Thematically, what is it that you think binds those poems together?
So I wrote these poems between 2018 and I guess 2022. And I think this is true of my first book, Barn Burner, as well. But I mean, I make no excuses for the fact that I'm writing about the time that we're currently in. and if you know, folks remember 2018 through 2022, those have been interesting years for all of us.
Yeah.
I also was, I was a faculty member in a visiting position at a school in Arkansas, which is a really wonderful school. But I wondered if I would be able to find a permanent work. So much about our future was up in the air. And so I wouldn't call the book an anxious book, but there is an anxiety about some of the issues of that time that are threaded through the book that I think people will recognize.
It's very modern in its themes. I just didn't know if there was any particular overarching theme that you thought, bound all the poems together.
Well, there is something that happens in the book that is different from my first book. So in my first book, there's kind of a speaker that you follow throughout all the poems. And one critic said, well, the speaker doesn't learn anything and her situation doesn't improve. There's a futility in that book.
Right.
Whereas in this book, I wanted to have, since I was dealing with all of these kind of like, who do I want to be? What kind of family do I want to have? How do I want to work and live and know other people in the world? I wanted the speaker to discover something about that. So the poems actually become more confident as you go along in their assertions. They're a little bit more questioning in the beginning. And then by the end, with that last poem I mentioned, What If Pain No Longer Ordered the Narrative? There's a little bit of peace with all of the kind of trauma that's occurred throughout the book.
Well, and that's an interesting point. I mean, I assume that writers will often tell me this, no matter what their genre is, that writing is therapeutic for them. And I assume that's true for poetry as well. So I have to ask, based on what you just said, is that where you are now compared to your first book, where there was not necessarily any answers, to where you are now, that you're a little more confident in your answers?
I would say so, especially in terms of being a single parent. It's interesting because I first made the decision to be a single parent, and then I made the decision, I had a child, and then I struggled with it for all of the reasons that single parents do, because there's not really supports in our society, or there's not, certainly economically, it's very difficult to be a single parent. So I was, struggling through all that. And eventually I decided kind of that my life was what it was, and that I'm proud of my life, and I'm proud of my family the way my family is. And, what I'm able to give my daughter, mm-hmm. I'm proud of those things. It doesn't matter what other people think of them, actually. It matters what we think of them.
Yeah, that's perfect. All right, so let me ask you this. There are numerous wonderful phrases in this book, okay? For example, I wrote a couple of them down, like, quote, the small mechanics of survival, close quote, or, quote, picture of words, close quote. Where do these come from? Do you write down phrases periodically that you don't necessarily know where they'll go, and then they end up in the poem, or do they evolve organically as you're writing?
That's such a good question. I would say it's a mix of both. So those notes I take on my phone, I mean, I could be in the middle of like having dinner with my daughter, or we're watching a movie together or something like that. And if some sort of phrase or image occurs to me, I'll write it down. But more often, I would say that it's through the writing process that I come up with those. And I'm very aware of a reader when I'm writing and how to, you know, I think a mistake that a lot of early or beginning writers make is that they have these great images in their head and these great kind of things in their mind. And then what they write ends up being just a summary of those rather than actually pulling them out and making them concrete on the page. So I'll sit there and I'll say, okay, you know, conceptually, for instance, with a picture of words, if these are, I was thinking of words that you give someone or things that you give someone. So what's a container for those? I could have said a box, you know, I could have said a glass, but then I was imagining like this glass, kind of a glass pitcher and pouring water out of it or really pouring care out of it. But it started with the idea of a container, right? And then I make that more specific and I call it a pitcher.
I got you. I don't know why, but maybe because I'm a music fan. When I read that, there's a line in a John Prine song. I think it's called Sam Stone, where he says, little pitchers have big ears. And so pitcher in that instance refers to children. And I know when I first read it, I paused because I had heard that before. All right. I'm curious about a couple other things before we talk about specific poems. And I've always been curious about this. How do you decide where to break stanzas in a poem? Because sometimes your stanzas are like four lines, sometimes they're two lines. How does that process work?
I tend to like regular stanzas. I think because I'm kind of a person who's always trying to order chaos. So a quatrain or a tercet or a couplet feels more orderly to me than stanzas of variable lengths or variable line lengths. Mm-hmm. So I think that's just sort of an inclination that I have. In this book, I was also really interested in using couplets because of the book's concern with dyads. So mm-hmm. there's the fact that the speaker who, you know, let's loosely identify her with the experiences of me, Erin Hoover, is unpartnered. So it's an incomplete pair. The pair is absent, but then there is the pair that keeps asserting itself, which is the pair of the mother and the daughter. So, you know, particularly in the long poem in the book Forms Materials, that's a poem that's consistently making and breaking and trying to make forms and break forms and reform over and over again. I think this book does that. No Spare People does this more than my first book. It was something that I sat down with some intention and wanted to do.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the first poem in the collection. And the title is On the Metaphor for Women of Birthing to Creative Activity. And you may have actually just partially answered this because one of the things that jumped out in me is you refer to, quote, binaries again and again, close quote. Talk about what you're referring to there.
So, I'm referring to the set, this conception of a woman's life as though there are, you know, a finite set of choices within it, which are often figured as binary. She's going to work or she's going to stay home. She's going to be a good mother or a bad mother. She's going to be someone who is uncreative, which is figured as responsible, actually. When you're a woman, you're supposed to kind of give up the things that you care for to care for others, including children. So she's going to be uncreative versus creative. So I'm saying that's, you know, it's a false binary that hopefully a woman can be creative, but also, you know, I didn't want to write this kind of very like 70s. The poem begins as almost like a 1970s second wave feminist poem. Right. And then it's trying to even move beyond the second wave assertions. I mean, I'm not doing this like let's have it all thing. It's right. It's more like, let's just say what it is. Like, mm-hmm. let's say what, rather than figuring it as a series of binary choices, let's just put it out there as the experience itself.
Yeah. You know, what struck me, and maybe I should ask the question this way, and then I'll tell you what I thought. Have you ever had somebody read your poems and tell you they got something out of it that you had no conception of when you wrote it?
Yes. Yes, it's happened.
Yeah, when I read the binary reference, and at least in my mind, as I was comparing it to the choices women have, I thought of I guess we might say the original binary choice between Eve and Mary, right? I mean, women can either be awful like Eve and or be, you know, virginal and pure, you know, like Mary. That's how it struck me when I first read it. This is this choice that you have to make.
Oh, that's true, because there are other poems in the book that look at the single woman as kind of a destabilizing force, right, always a threat to the marriages of others, not really fitting into the community in a way that makes sense to people.
Yeah.
So, right, yeah, so, that's fair.
Okay. So many of the poems, you mentioned this earlier, have contemporary facts in them. Okay. And so, for example, there's a poem called 3 Weeks, where there's a reference to Nicole Simpson. And in the poem, if my memory's right, the writer is comparing herself to Nicole Simpson. Talk about how you came up with that idea.
Yeah. Actually, this is something that started, I think I'd either seen a documentary or I was reading an article, and I don't really remember which one it was. But I read that Nicole Simpson had only recently been out of her parents' house for 3 weeks before she met O.J. Simpson. So she was really only free and on her own for 3 weeks. So that's where the 3 weeks comes from. Cause I thought, what a terrifyingly short amount of time. And I thought about what I would consider that same period of time in my own life, which was where, you know, in my adolescence, where I couldn't wait. I couldn't wait to give away my freedom. I couldn't wait to be paired off with a man. I was, you know, it made me very nervous to be maybe having gone through puberty and be an adult and to be on my own. It made me very nervous. So it's really the story of that. And of course, Nicole Brown Simpson met, you know, Nicole Brown became Nicole Brown, right. Simpson met OJ, and we know what happened there. I met the person I met. In some ways, we all meet the person we meet, or we all, again, that's a choice. You know, you decide to be in a pair or not. But yeah, it was, her time was really short, and I'm heartbroken by the degree to which I wanted my time to be short.
I got you. Okay. There's another poem that I'm curious about called Praying Inside the Emergency. That's the name of the poem. What is the nature of prayer there?
Yeah. So I, again, this is based off a real experience. I was a member of a prayer circle in a Presbyterian church in Arkansas, which was so helpful in terms of helping to create a community for us there. That was where I was, you know, temporarily living. So I would go to this prayer circle, and I realized, you know, we would ask, okay, what do people want to pray for? And it was always these horrible stories of things that were happening to people that we were asking for help from God with. And I started thinking, what is the function of this prayer circle? Like, it almost seemed like the fact that we were saying it was even more important than praying to God. And I thought, in some ways, I thought, well, is speaking about one's pain or speaking about one's fears, is that really a form of prayer? Is that what we're doing? Are we praying when we do that? And to me, it seemed almost like, it seemed very spiritual. I was thinking about, like, to what extent is someone able to assert their will or their sense of good in the world, which is why that poem gets into all that stuff about voting and protesting and trying to assert a kind of goodness, yeah, against forces that are maybe less positive in our culture.
All right. Well, we're going to keep on this theme of talking about specific poems, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
There's a poem entitled, because I actually think, I know this is true for me, I'm always fascinated by what's not only in the poem, but what's behind the poem, what prompted it. So there's a poem called White Woman, in which you write about the mannerisms of men. I'm apologizing for all of us, about our culture. But you end up writing, quote, that you search for my way out. What would that look like? And did you succeed at that?
Yeah, so... I'm going to answer that question with, yeah. Now, that poem, again, is about the choice of living within the kind of white patriarchy. It sort of blends white supremacy and patriarchy there, because to me, it felt like the same kind of organizational system that I was writing against. And yet, I do think that white women are always somewhat participants in, because of whiteness, in that kind mm-hmm. of power dynamic. Mm-hmm. So the question is, when you come across, again, one of these everyday occurrences, a man opening the door for you, you know, people are going to say, oh, Erin Hoover, you can't even open the door for her. But, you know, when that happens, there's kind of the, how do I respond to that? Like, to what extent am I participating in all of this? And, you know, I am a white woman, but do I have to, is there a way out? Is there a way out of being a white woman, you know, or being, being part of the patriarchy? I'm still searching, I guess.
Yeah, that's a fascinating idea, because it's not about not being a white woman per se. It's about getting outside of this cultural dome that's kind of been put on top of everything.
Yes.
Have you read, I mean, just as an aside, there's a book by Eldridge Cleaver, a Black Panther from long ago, called Soul on Ice. I don't know if you've ever read it, but he talks about the relationship, and it's very fascinating, about the relationship between white men and white women. Pick it up one day if you have nothing else, if you haven't read it. Soul on Ice by Eldridge Cleaver. Now, there's another poem that I could relate to called What Use Are You? Okay, that's in quotes. And you seem to be questioning your value as a teacher, although I think the implications are much broader. The poem refers to both a small god and then later a large god. Can you tell me what you mean by those references?
Oh, yes. Okay. So the small god is the Scantron sheet. It's the way we are measuring achievement. And I was thinking about how the little dots of the Scantron sheet look like little screaming mouths. maybe students have felt that when they've looked at their Scantron sheets. And then the large god is really kind of the bigger. So I think that there's scarcity in educational institutions because of like a larger project to kind of, you know, a culture that doesn't necessarily value education, that doesn't kind of see the interest in education as a form of citizen making. Or, you know, when we're taking that Scantron test, are we really learning to follow our dreams? And is the university organized in a way that really promotes students following their dreams? You know, in that poem, there's the student who really wants to major in creative writing, but he's decided to major in psychology because his parents want him to. And he doesn't even know what psychology is about. You know, he sort of picked this major that to him feels more, more relevant because he's been told it's more relevant. So I was thinking about those, the way those things manifest.
Yeah, you know, but it has much larger implications. As a retiree, I'm retired. It struck me as a conversation I've had with many of my retired friends who basically say, what is my relevance now? What is my use now? So I thought the point, while it was clear what you were saying in reference to teaching, had much larger implications. And it worked just really well. Now, the longest poem is titled Forms and Materials, okay? And if I'm reading it correctly, you come out in that poem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But you also write, quote, I didn't want women or men, only an intellectual life, close quote. Have you achieved that? Because if so, I want to know how.
Well, yeah, the poem is in many ways a coming of age story about all the ways a person can be sexualized. And a desire to resist that, or how do I live outside of that? I think at the end of the poem, what happens is I decide to take what I want of different pieces of gender expectations and to make my family out of that. I mean, I can't say enough how much, for me, you know, I'm not saying everyone run out and have a kid on your own. It's great. It'll change your life. But for me doing that, in some ways freed me from a lot of constraints that had been on me before. And I decided to make, I mean, this may sound like the ultimate kind of mother as self-sacrifice. It's not that. It's that my form of motherhood with my daughter is an affirmation of the life that I want to live. And in some ways, you know, what my sexuality looks like at this point is just a manifestation of that, of whatever choices I'm going to make in a given day.
Yeah. I thought it was really, I'm fascinated by the request to, you want an intellectual life, because that is so rare these days, unfortunately. All right. So I often ask, and let me see, I probably will end with this. I often ask fiction writers, you know, when they create fictional characters and they put them in situations and they have to figure out how to get out of them, you know, what do you learn about yourself? Because you've got to go through that thought process. Is the question of self-knowledge and what is gained from it relevant to the poet?
I mean, I would say that writing this, I mean, we mentioned that writing can be therapeutic. I think it has been for me. I also think that, you know, in some ways, there's that line from Rukeyser, if one woman told the truth about her life, the world would split open. I mean, I'm still in that project. I know that's an old project. It's been going on for decades, but I think the nature of what exactly we need to say is always changing decade by decade. And I think that that process of saying is useful to the reader. It's useful to the writer. I mean, people have told me that they really see themselves in this book or have been able to grapple with some of the same things that I've been working on. So, I mean, that means a lot to me. I'm sort of a community oriented person, and I like to think of myself as writing in a continuum in that way.
That's great. Erin, unfortunately, this is all the time we have for today. Folks, you've been listening to the Writers Forum, and I've been speaking to poet Erin Hoover about her new poetry collection, No Spare People. Let me make a comment about it. You know, so many people, all of us, I guess, live our life at the level of the veneer. This is a book that goes into the hardwood and makes you think, and I highly recommend it. Erin, is there a website or other social media site that folks can go to in order to learn more about the book and maybe more about yourself and your other writings?
Sure. My website is erinhooverpoet.com. The book is for sale on Black Lawrence Press's website. I would also encourage people to get it through Small Press Distribution, spd.org, or through Bookshop.
Okay, great. Thanks, Erin. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right, folks, music for the show was provided by Valerie Hunt Jester, and the show is produced by our very own Tyler O'Brien. Tune in next Tuesday at 4 p.m. or Wednesday at 5:30 a.m. for the next segment of the Writers Forum.